Constant listeners, this is the Far Middle Podcast, episode number 20. If we're using sports numbers for our episodes, number 20, I'm trying to think of a great sports hero of past. Let's go with Rocky Blyer. He was a 20, and his book, Fighting Back, that's a heck of a story and a great representative for episode number 20. Leaves are turning. It's October. For me, that's always been a fun time of year. I like it because primarily of sports. You've got high school football in full swing. You got those long weekends, those Friday through Sunday nights, where you got playoff baseball, which to me anymore is the only sort of baseball worth watching. I've adopted the Dodgers, by the way, since the Pirates have just absolutely stunk for so many years, but I'll be rooting for the Dodgers. You got college football in full swing, of course. That's always fun. Pro football is in season form. So you got all those things converging. And then you always got that Saturday night boxing event, which just adds to the things to watch and the different opportunities. So it's a great time of year for the calendar when it comes to sports. Temperatures are good. They start to moderate. You're still able to work in the yard. It's not too cold to do that. But as they say on Game of Thrones, winter is coming, and that means some rough sledding, pun intended, for areas like Pittsburgh and the northern areas of the country. We've got some dots to connect this week on episode 20. What I want to talk about are what appear to be separate issues, but they tie together with the themes that we'll discuss. The first one is the vibe of Washington, D.C. as a city today. I had a chance to visit there and experience some things and share those observations with you. And then jump to the second dot of the increasingly shredded veneer of our president, President Biden. Then another dot, the third one, how the elite in Washington, D.C. and their policies are helping the rich and consciously doing so and hurting the middle class. And then we'll jump over to how Fed monetary policy and government fiscal policy, they're converging together to decouple markets from reality. And then we'll wrap with our fifth and final point to connect or dot, which is how government has been really in many ways cooking its books, I'll say it financially, to give an image of something versus reality. And it's trying to shroud that reality, the financial reality of what's facing the government, the taxpayers, and of course, the country. So that's a full slate. Let's get started with that first one, which is what's going on with Washington, D.C. as a city in sort of late summer, early fall 2021. I did some traveling for the first time in a long time the past couple of weeks, and one of the stops in my travels brought me to our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. I've made dozens of trips to D.C. through the years, and I feel like I know it pretty well. But this trip, there was something different. I felt like something was off when it came to Washington. I was staying just north of DuPont Circle, and I had business downtown as well, so I was moving back and forth across the city from day to day. And for the first full day, I couldn't place my finger on what it was that was off. And then it finally, at some point, hit me in that first day. The town itself is full. So you don't see parking spots available anywhere. There's people jetting to and from on those annoying scooters. I don't know if you've seen the scooters in these urban areas, but they're driving me nuts. I would love to see data on vehicular accidents with them or people on the scooters running into people walking or running. They're just an annoying sight to me. But they're all over the place. But yet there's hardly any traffic during the workday. So the streets are empty when it comes to just cars driving to and from. And there's not these bottlenecks and long lines of cars and traffic jams that you're used to with a place like Washington, D.C. What gives? Well, I finally figured it out. No one is going to work in Washington, D.C. anymore. The entire city has gone remote. And I can tell you, I can attest for you that going remote work, it does not equate to working. Those two things are different. Because during working hours, you look around, the coffee shops are full, the dog parks are packed, and there are a lot of businesses that are closed, but they're closed not because there aren't customers. They're closed because there's no workers that they can find to staff the business establishments. I think DC's veneer has been exposed in a way. It was a city originally built on sort of the idea or the premise of government and its allies taking appropriating value from doers and consuming it for the bureaucracy or for the benefit of the bureaucracy. At least then, the bureaucrats showed up for work when they appropriated the value of taxpayers and the middle class and doers in the private sector. Today, the bureaucrats don't even need to show up. COVID pandemic, it's presented a wonderful opportunity to work from home and remotely appropriate value of others. DC is full of bureaucrats collecting a full paycheck from the couch, from the dog park, from the coffee shop, or at least the coffee shop that's got enough workers to staff it and to man it. Now, the rest of us, we're paying for it, and the bill only gets bigger with each new multi-trillion dollar package. I got to hand it to the bureaucracy and sort of the entrenched tentacles of the deep state. What a diabolical genius win that is for the bureaucracy. My recent trip to DC brings me to the second dot, because when I was there at different points, depending on where I was at, I had little glimpses or images of the White House or parts of it. And that second point that I want to talk about is the snowballing incompetency and dishonesty, frankly, of the Biden administration. Incompetency by itself, that's always going to be a problem, of course. Dishonesty by itself is always going to be troubling. The two of them together, that makes me very concerned about the future of this nation and the state of the world. Examples of this administration's malfeasance, they keep piling up, and the past few weeks offered up another set of examples, very tangible examples, that, as I said, they just continue to accumulate and pile up. First, the Afghan debacle, it won't go away. The recent drone strike news feed showed this. First, you had President Biden saying that a drone strike in late August killed an ISIS leader. So this was, of course, the president's moment to show his tough on terror response to the murder of our Marines and servicemen and women at the Kabul airport. Then that story changed, right? The administration said at some point after that that some civilians were killed with the ISIS terrorists. So regrettable killing of innocent civilians, but we still got a terrorist with respect to the drone strike. And General Milley went so far to call the strike sort of during that period of time righteous. That was the term that he used. Now we learn the truth after all that sort of storytelling. The truth is 10 civilians dead, 7 kids dead, 0 terrorists dead. That's not a good score or fact pattern when it comes to that incident coming right off of the killing and murders at the airport. Then there is the mess that's going on at the Texas border. I don't think this mess is, you know, as frustrating and as troubling as it is, should surprise anyone when you consider or couple with it the bungled messaging that the administration's created with the border crisis that shows really no signs of waning over time. You got thousands of refugees. One count I saw at one point was around 15,000 that are stuck under a highway overpass day after day in heat. And when the media started to show these aerial footage feeds that you saw of the crowds, what was the answer there? Let's not address the problem. Let's not fix the problem. Instead, the federal government grounded the drone flights so you couldn't see the video feeds anymore. Make the problem appear to go away. You know, focus on the optics, not the tangible solutions. Our Secretary of Homeland Security, his quote, I thought was a classic one. He said, quote, "We are surging resources and we have a multi-pronged approach to this," end quote. There goes some bureaucratic speak, a prime example of it. And why doesn't that make me feel any better? Why don't I believe a word of that? Then there's the vaccine mess. And really the vaccine mess with pandemic is manifesting in two parts over the past week or two. Part one is our Vice President Harris, who was saying last year that she wouldn't take the vaccine because it came about during the Trump administration. Now she's saying that the rest of us must take the vaccine that haven't already, or we're going to get fired or fined out of existence. I took the vaccine. I received the vaccine. And when I did that and made that decision, the last thing I was worried about was who or what party was living in the White House at the time. I didn't know that had anything to do with the science, but apparently it has a lot to do with the science, at least as far as Vice President Harris is concerned. And part two of the vaccine mess was the president's speech a couple weeks ago in mid-September. I don't know if you caught it, where in the same speech, he said, first, if you're vaccinated, your chance for serious illness was extremely small. Okay, that makes sense to me. But then in the same speech, he said that the unvaccinated are going to have to be required to be vaccinated to protect the health of those that are already vaccinated. Obviously, again, just following logic, both statements cannot be true. President Biden, his administration, and his handlers have lost a tremendous amount of credibility. I don't know if they can, frankly, recover from it. Everyone sees it, and it's been self-induced or largely self-induced. Whenever you have incompetence coupled with dishonesty, it's not going to be a good optic. It's not a good approach to anything in life, and it certainly is not a winning formula politically or for our nation. this administration's and Washington's deceptions, they manifest in current fiscal policy, which brings us to our third dot. A prime example of how this pops up in fiscal policy is found when you look at the Democrats' $3.5 trillion spending bill. You combine that with climate change religion of the left and the focus of subsidizing the elite and the rich, the well-to-do. What I'm talking about is that buried within all this massive spending debate is extending the tax credit subsidy for the buyers of electric vehicles. So you see, we were told that electric vehicles would save the planet from boiling under the religion of climate change, which of course is not true. But despite the lie, only 3% of car sales in this country are electric. And since they're more expensive than combustion engine cars, the buyers are typically going to be better to do or more wealthier. And typically, they're going to be from places like California. I want to say that around 40%, somewhere in that neighborhood of U.S. electric vehicle sales, they're in California. The House Ways and Means Committee, they want to extend the tax credits for the electric vehicle sales, and they want to raise the threshold to those who receive the tax credits to couples making up to $800,000 a year. So if you make $750,000 up to $800,000 a year as a couple, you are able to enjoy these tax credits and the subsidy for electric vehicle sales under what the proposal is that's being considered or proposed by the House Ways and Means Committee. Now, who does this help if this actually occurs? Of course, high-income households are going to be a winner. California and big East Coast cities are going to be winners that sort of favor electric vehicles and have these types of wealthy buyers. Multi-billion dollar corporations, it could be a Tesla, it could be a GM, whoever's manufacturing these and selling these to consumers are going to win. So it's a subsidy for multi-billion dollar corporations. Places like China, where a lot of the materials for electric vehicles have to be mined and processed, they're going to love this. And government bureaucrats who are going to have to manage the complex programs that come with all this, of course, they're going to grow, they're going to benefit. Who's the losers? Who pays for all this? Well, it's what you would expect. The middle class, who can't afford the cars or don't want them, but they're going to have to pay taxes to cover the subsidy to the rich and to the corporations. It's going to be flyover country, who are partial to gasoline-powered trucks and cars, SUVs. It's going to be the climate, because the science of the matter is that the life cycle carbon intensity of electric vehicles powered by renewables is far from zero, and it's much worse than a car powered by gasoline. So if you're concerned about CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, you're not going to be happy about this if you're following the math and the science. But yet the charade and the manipulation of the science and the facts and the dollars, they're all going to continue. And this now lets us jump to our fourth thought, which is what happens to markets when you combine dual paths of government manipulation. You got the Fed monetary policy, aka free money, on one side, colliding with government policy like the EV mandates, the electric vehicle mandates, or the $3.5 trillion spending package that we just spoke about as examples. The combination of these two things, it creates market bubbles in the private sector that completely disconnect from fundamentals and common sense. I read an article recently that compared valuations for In Vogue or sexy stock picks that you're hearing about everywhere to just nuts and bolts companies that actually do or make something. And then I sort of read that article, looked at those examples, and followed them up with some of my own that I found through my own research. It's scary. That's the best word that I can sort of use to describe this. We can start just with the overall S&P. It's priced at a lofty price-to-earnings ratio of 22 times, which should cause rational investors some discomfort. It causes me some discomfort as an investor in the S&P. But individual examples that you find with individual companies and stocks, they're even more shocking. There's a company out there, Joby Aviation, that wants to do electric air taxis in a few years. So it's a tech company, electric air taxis, it'll pick you up or shuttle or ferry goods or individuals. And it's got a plan of being able to get this thing demonstrated and actually running in a couple of years, sort of like the Jetsons is how I think of it, for those of you that were a fan of the cartoon series, the Jetsons. That company, Joby Aviation, is valued today more than Lufthansa, which actually does air travel today. You can fly to Europe on Lufthansa today. You can't take an air taxi under Joby Aviation anytime in the near future, but it's got a higher valuation than Lufthansa. Airbnb, which I've used many times, love it, you know, great service, but it is a service, right? It's just linking up people that want to rent a house or a place with someone that's got the ownership of it. Airbnb is worth more than Hilton and Marriott. Not Hilton or Marriott, Hilton and Marriott combined. That's an amazing fact. AMC, the movie theater, its stock price shot from $2 to, I want to say, around $50 in a very short period of time, less than a year. And that was during a period of time when you had COVID effectively shutting down all the demand of the theater. Couldn't go see movies during that time because of shutdown policies. So you got all of its demand being killed on top of it, but its stock went from $2 to $50. Why? Because online speculators ran it up. You've got Carvana. That's that company that has it's a sales company with those towers of cars that you see near highways. They sort of look like giant vending machines for cars. Pretty cool sort of visual that it creates. Carvana is worth more than Honda. I mean, Honda actually makes the cars. Carvana just finds a way to sell them under some sort of unique or nice marketing mechanism. It's worth more than Honda, the entity that makes the cars. You also see it outside of stocks and companies. I mean, you start looking at the collectible market. I follow the collectible markets, whether it's it could be baseball, trading cards, it could be coins, art, et cetera. I like following that stuff as a hobby. I saw a couple months ago a Patrick Mahomes rookie card from 2017. Patrick Mahomes is a young quarterback, so his rookie card isn't that long ago, 2017 rookie card. It sold at auction for $4.3 million. $4.3 million. 4 years old, not a T206 Honus Wagner card, as Allen Iverson would say. I'll channel him. Not a game, right? We're talking about practice. Not a T206 Honus Wagner card. We're talking about a 2017 Patrick Mahomes card. $4.3 million. Even perhaps nuttier, and that's hard to beat, but even maybe I got one that beats that, Mahomes card. An Italian artist sold for $18,000 what he sort of labeled or dubbed as an immaterial sculpture. Now, what does that mean? That means it doesn't exist. So the buyer didn't acquire a sculpture, but instead the buyer received what the artist called, quote, a space full of energy, end quote. Folks, I'm not making this up. This stuff is actually happening and transacting in the market today. In all of this stuff, it's the result of what happens when you got free money through Fed policy converging with government fiscal policy that is designed to reward and subsidize certain winners at the expense of others. When these two are in the trillions of dollars each and they collide, reality distorts to a fiction that we call in the capital markets bubbles. And the recent stock market volatility that you saw in late September and what we're probably going to see for the rest of this year, that is a surefire sign that people are starting to catch on and people are starting to get antsy. They should be getting antsy. And if that free fall begins, it might be a long way down to where we establish a sort of grounding, I'll call it, with reality. Now, how government learned to manufacture asset bubbles in the capital markets using this voodoo math, that takes us to our fifth and final dot for this episode of The Far Middle, which is when government cooks its own financial books to deceive taxpayers. Congress in Washington, they game the rules. An example of this, you've got a congressional rule that demands that spending bills have to project their cost over 10 years. That's a congressional budgeting rule. So when Congress put forth its $3.5 trillion spending bill recently, that's what is now being marketed. I saw this as social infrastructure. What a great term that is. It made sure it showed up as some outlays, particularly for things like Medicare expansion. It would show up only set to expire in 3 years. So it was only a three-year plan for something like Medicare expansion. That let Congress avoid adding the cost of Medicare expansion to the advertised price tag of the $3.5 trillion. It helped lower that advertised price tag because it assumed they would go away in 3 years instead of having to show 10 years of it unless it stated otherwise under the congressional rules. But we all know those programs, those types of entitlement expansions, they never expire. Once implemented or expanded, they are perpetual. Now, if you add these types of true costs to the price tag, the $3.5 trillion, it goes to $5 trillion under different estimates from entities that have estimated that. And $5 trillion, I'll add or remind you, with no obvious or logical way to pay for it all. So a troubling $3.5 trillion price tag in reality is probably much worse than that. It's probably north of around $5 trillion. But this is nothing new. Democrats and Republicans, frankly, they've been playing the charade with taxpayers forever. Those of us who are old enough to recall might remember the federal government was running budget surpluses during the late 90s. But during those same years, the government debt increased. Now, how can that be? How can you have a budget surplus, but your debt be growing? Well, it's the funny math once again, where during that time, the surpluses to things like Social Security, they were both borrowed by the government and counted as income by the government. So that's how you get into the voodoo math and the voodoo economics. I've mentioned, I think, in a couple prior podcasts and in my upcoming book, it also we also talk about this, a professor Kotlikoff from Boston University. He did the legitimate math of government debt, and his number is a little bit higher than the official debt that you'll see of 28 plus trillion. So 28 plus trillion scares me, it worries me, it concerns me. But when you do the legitimate math like Professor Kotlikoff has, his number is not 28 plus trillion, his number is 240 trillion. And what he's doing is he's counting all the commitments to Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, sort of the off-balance sheet commitments, the real commitments, but the ones that government pretends don't exist or don't count towards the debt. So his math is logical as well as out there for everyone to see. It's very transparent. I'd encourage you to give it a look and add it up like he did. So look, the federal government and the Fed, they are not all powerful. Government bureaucrats, they can't use magical math that make the financially unsustainable suddenly sustainable forever. That's not going to work. That trick will not work. Most people would look at this and say a public corporation, if a public corporation was doing this, and they would look at it and cry fraud. And by the way, Professor Kotlikoff wanted to introduce a bill at one point requiring the government, when they're showing their budget numbers, when they're calculating their debt, to apply GAAP accounting rules, just like public corporations have to do when it's reporting these budgets and numbers, et cetera. When he put that proposal forward, out of the 100 senators that we've got in the Senate, eight out of 100 supported it. Yet government gets away with the ruse year after year, and the taxpayer seems no wiser to the reality. I think we should do what we can to make the taxpayer wiser to the reality. So that's our five dots that we want to connect in this episode, helps us bring us to the wrap up. But you know what? I just thought of something just speaking here. How about a sixth dot? How about a bonus dot to throw out there? We're talking about federal government and obfuscating the data, the budgets, the debt, those types of things. It reminds me, just thinking about this, Alan Greenspan, prior Fed chairman, who had that term purposeful obfuscation, right? He was famous for saying, if you understood me, I must have misspoken. So this is nothing new for government, but I was thinking about Alan Greenspan and the federal government, how they play games with the math and the budgets and the books. And it brought to mind sort of two NFL and college football coaching legends who are friends. You got Bill Belichick, right, in the NFL up in New England, and Nick Saban down in Alabama in college football. They worked together back in the day with the Browns, I think it was, when Saban was the defensive coordinator for Belichick when he was head coach. So they go way back. I think they have some Navy Academy connections as well. But boy, can you find two different individuals, right? You got purposeful obfuscation Belichick, who, listening to his press conferences or his interchanges with the media, you're just completely wasting time. He designs it to say absolutely nothing and to be as cloudy and opaque as possible, sort of a la Alan Greenspan. But then you've got, in the federal government with their bookkeeping, but then you got Nick Saban, who is actually quite the opposite. His press conferences, I don't know if you've ever listened to them, they're really entertaining. You never know what he's going to say. He's going to be very transparent at times, and he's going to be brutally honest most times. So he doesn't shy away from controversy and content and tangible views on things. So there's a bonus dot for you, where you go from purposeful obfuscation within government and its books to the sports analogy of a legendary coach that embraces it, and then one of his contemporaries and friends who's also legendary in his own right that takes the exact opposite route. Well, that wraps up episode 20 of the Far Middle Podcast. Again, on Twitter, you can follow me at Nick Deolius. Take a look at the website if you get a chance for new content, nickdeolius.com. Almost forgot, too, when you're looking at the website and if you're checking out Amazon for some news on the upcoming January release of my book, I've got two pieces of news here quickly. First release date looks to be January 17th, 2022. So the first piece of news is the release date is January 17th of this upcoming year. Very excited about that. Second piece of news is we are changing the name from The Leech to something that has become, I think, even more fitting in late 2021, early 2022 when the book's coming out. I'm not going to tell you, the new name yet. That's what the media pros call a teaser. But I encourage you and try to use that to have you check it out, the website and the Amazon site. We'll have more to say in upcoming podcasts on the new title. And I think you're going to like this new title. So until then, stay safe. Remember, this is not a dress rehearsal. This is real life. Make it count. Talk to you soon.